Great. Thank you, Asaf. Thank you so much for having me. And thanks to those of you who are, I guess I'm so used to saying zooming in, but logging in on this beautiful Wednesday afternoon. It's a little unusual for me to not actually see everybody or the usual squares that I often see when I talk. So I'll do the best I can to stare into the computer here. Also forgive the appearance of the webinar. I'm in the middle of moving, so I couldn't find my ties and the books behind me. I have not been organized, so I apologize. I know some people are very critical of book organization, and I'm not there quite yet. So I wanna thank the Scholars for Peace in the Middle East for having me. And you know, usually I say I'm happy to be here. And while I'm obviously happy to be here, I think it's a wonderful group with wonderful people. I'd be lying if I said I'm not a little frustrated and a little even sick and tired of having to talk about Jewish life, having to talk about cultural divides, political divides, and the seemingly endless culture wars that we are in. It's getting a little old, a little frustrating. But you know, today I wanted to share some data which suggests that, you know, I think we may be on the upswing, and I think there's some light at the end of the tunnel here. Before I do that, I wanted to opine briefly about a piece I had read last week in Barry Weiss's Substack. And the reason I wanted to mention that is that as we talk about political divides and religious and community divides, some of the biggest actors in creating those divides and then hopefully healing those divides are college faculty. I believe that at this point, the Jewish community is not particularly exceptional in terms of how it is positioned in American society. Younger Jews are behaving like just typical Americans, and we're not particularly unusual. As a result, you know, so many ideas, so many problems, so many advances and setbacks come from higher education, come from faculty, come from the higher ed space. And often ideas sort of germinate and percolate on college and university campuses, and then they sort of slip into the larger communal zeitgeist. And that's sort of where I think we are now with cancel culture, censorship, and so on. So I wanted to mention, again, Weiss's Substack, where there was a piece by Joseph Manson. He's an anthropologist, or was an anthropologist at UCLA, also, like me, a professor. And he wrote I think, a very well-written, well-edited piece about why he's leaving higher education, why he decided to resign his position in the anthropology department at UCLA. Now, I've spent a lot of time looking at various departments in the higher ed space, and without a doubt, you know, the anthropology departments, they are among the most progressive, what I would call woke. That's a slippery definition, so I try not to use it, but in my view, or for general parlance, it's fairly woke. And folks in anthropology rarely today see themselves as ivory tower academics. They see themselves in many cases as scholar activists. They see themselves as there to right wrongs. They see themselves as communal organizers, not just, again, ivory tower academics. And he wrote this beautiful piece where he talked about what it's like being Jewish. He talked about what it's like seeing the rise of anti-Semitism on college, on his campus. He talked about the rise of how, you know, ideology or progressive ideology in sort of echo chambers where faculty members would hire and promote people very similar to them with similar ideologies, attitudes, and views. And he then anchored that nicely in some other work, which basically says, look, the academy and higher education is not hospitable or open to Jewish ideas and the Jewish community at this point. It's hard for me to argue with that. In many respects, I think he's right. I think what he's describing is true. I have been dealing with similar things at Sarah Lawrence for years. You know, when I over my almost 15 years at the college, when swastikas have been painted on my door and I've said something, various people at the school have said, oh, just take them down and ignore it. No one's going to do much. And they haven't. If there were some form of hate, you know, on another person's door based on race, ethnicity, gender, sexuality, and so on, the school would be up in arms. Public statements would be released. Investigations would happen. They certainly didn't. I understand what Manson's dealing with to a degree, where there's just casual anti-Semitism all the time, at various faculty meetings, among lunches and things like that. I'm regularly told, oh, well, the Jewish apartheid, there are always insinuations about Jewish power, Jewish organizational power and wealth. It's disgusting. It's very unpleasant to be around. But I didn't leave. And I just wanted to comment on, again, I've never met Professor Manson. I'm sure he struggled. I certainly would love to chat with him. And I certainly don't deny that he had some difficulty being around UCLA. But I was troubled that the piece basically said, I'm now leaving. I'm over this. I don't like it anymore. This is a fight we may have lost. I think that's a mistake. I have made a very conscientious choice a number of years ago after my family was threatened, the lives of my children were threatened, my office was ransacked, and so on, to not walk away. And I'm not looking for praise, but to me, my very existence being there, first of all, bothers a lot of my colleagues, bothers the administration. I can call them out. I can try to hold them accountable. And I can serve, more importantly, as a role model. I can push back. I can be a role model to students. And once you start doing that, and Manson's piece did not talk about undergrads at all, but once you start pushing back on the administration, students notice. Once you start, at least in my case, openly talking about viewpoint diversity, about the pleasures and pitfalls of open discourse, dialogue, and debate, and in my case, talking about my Judaism and my faith, my classes were always oversubscribed. Students would line up to talk to me. People would make appointments to see me regularly. And I cannot tell you how many late night phone calls I've had with students who have been frustrated. And I sit there and try to provide some form of support. So while I certainly understand that there's an impulse to leave and walk away and say, hey, we're done. We're going to cede this ground. I think that's a mistake. I think that's a huge mistake. And I think that we can be role models if we cede this ground, these progressive impulses are going to just spread. It's going to be dangerous, in my view, for not only higher education, but for society as a whole, largely because our political divide, which then leads to religious and communal divides, often emanate from the academy and from our students and from what goes on these campuses. There's that famous saying that the academy can be so contentious because it doesn't matter. Sadly, at this point, I would say in many respects, it matters more than one may ever believe. So ideas, no longer have stayed within the gates, but, ideas about how to deal with DEI have now pervaded into so many other spaces, whether it's K-12, work, various levels of government, state, local, federal. We see it all over the finance community, the legal community, and so on. And it's, in my view, very problematic. It's reductionist. It eliminates passion, and it's creating a significant mental health issues for our students. So thank you for letting me opine on that. I figured that would be just something I wanted to share. I think I'll write a little bit more about it. So I figured what I would do is not talk for a huge amount of time, since Q&A, especially with this community, is going to be more fun, but talk a little bit about my own little story dealing with political divides, religious and community divides. Because for better or for worse, the last 20 years, I've unintentionally watched this story unfold around me. And the reason I say that is, I went to Stanford as an undergraduate. I went there as a Jewish kid from the East Coast, from Philadelphia. And I, was excited. I was excited because I loved ideas. I went to Akiba Hebrew Academy in the Philadelphia area. Back then, it was truly far more pluralistic than it is today. And we would have the whole, range of views. And there were days I would be happy. There were days I would be unhappy. I lived in a dormitory where Jews were not very common. So East Coast understandings of Judaism and Jewish American life were not the norm. Certainly, I did not know about various cultures at the time. And I'm very grateful that I learned about them. I went to my first Bangra by the Bay. I had bubble tea, and I learned so much. We argued with each other. We asked each other, quite frankly, questions that would be viewed as quite insensitive and inappropriate today. I loved being asked weird things, and I certainly appreciated that my lifelong friends would be open to me asking questions that might be viewed as insensitive or inappropriate. It was a wonderful experience. We had quite a bit of viewpoint diversity. I would go to bed angry, but there were no administrators. No one was telling me what to say, what to do. There were no thought police. At orientation, I wasn't told how to do, you know, how to ask questions, what I can say, what I can't say. We just did it, and we worked it out as adults in training. I think about the dormitory that I lived in. We had a speaker series, and it was the public policy themed dormitory. And I'll never forget, one night we had Dinesh D'Souza, who by today's standards would be protested just by being invited. We also had people like Sherman Alexie. And for all of these events, we had large numbers of students. I remember evenings we would stay in the halls with them till 11, 12 at night until they had to leave. People were not disrespectful. They listened. If they were frustrated, they might leave. But we certainly had meaningful, interesting conversations that have sort of ceased to continue. When it went off to grad school in the Boston area, I lived in a little bit of a bubble. When I was in graduate school, I spent a lot of time writing about political divides and red and blue states, and tried to understand what was going on with our political system at large. And then in about 2008, 2009, I started teaching at Sarah Lawrence, and I noticed some very big issues. So this is over the course of about 14 years. And once I got to Sarah Lawrence, I noticed that rather than looking for, everyone okay? Got it. I just heard some background noise. The narrative changed. The narrative was no longer about finding similarities. The narrative was no longer about finding common ground.
Muted.
But it was about being different. Now, at Stanford, being different was certainly good and celebrated, but it was also about trying to find consensus and how to work together and celebrate the difference. At Sarah Lawrence, being different was a virtue in and of itself, and you were supposed to say, therefore, we can't find necessarily common ground. I noticed that students began to shut down conversations, and students in my seminar came to my classes. They didn't want to talk. I noticed, unlike my own collegiate experience, that there were administrators everywhere. And I started receiving memos about what could be said, what couldn't be said. Students were expected to go to an endless stream of meetings and presentations from various groups about how they should think, how they should feel. And suddenly, a number of terms began to become fairly common. I kept hearing the word genocide. People were committing genocide. People kept saying Nazism, although they really had no understanding of what that was. The word apartheid was invoked constantly. I also began to notice that we began to hear the word identity politic all the time, and saying, if I'm X, Y, and Z, I therefore can comment on A, B, and C, and because you're not X, Y, and Z, you can't comment on A, B, and C. We heard incredible numbers of harm narratives. And one of my least favorite things, the term lived experience. Feel free, by the way, to visit my webpage at the American Enterprise Institute, where I write about all of these things. Lived experience was the idea, basically, that if you have had a certain experience, it must be true. Well, it may be true to you, and certainly I'm not going to deny the legitimacy of a student's lived experience, but just because one person had a particular set of narrative stories or things happen to them, it certainly doesn't mean that's generalizable or necessarily absolutely true. And this became very, very difficult to teach. This was a very odd environment. I would assign books, and rather than paying attention to the ideas, the students said, well, if the author is X, Y, and Z, the book is invalid. That became hugely problematic. So I started pausing and saying, all right, what the heck is going on here? And I said to myself at the same time, I'm actually a trained political scientist, and I've been writing about political division for an awful long time. So I realized maybe I can combine these things, and I started researching what the heck is going on. I spoke with so many people in higher ed, and I realized that, you know, we often talk about professors, we often talk about students, but, you know, from an institutional perspective, there's another class of individuals on campus that are huge, and that's the college administrators, and they're having a huge impact on what we do and how we do it. So I began to look into it. And what I realized very quickly is that while we talked about in the political sphere the idea of sorting after the 2000s, we basically had this universe where if you were Republican, you would have to believe in a certain set of values. If you were a Democrat, you'd believe in another set of values. You had a middle that was confused, not particularly civic, not particularly participatory, but those on the right and those on the left would no longer cross over. We used to have this thing called cross-cutting cleavages and ideas where you could be a Republican, but you could believe X, Y, and Z about guns or abortion or immigration. By the mid-2000s and so on, that ceased to exist. If you were a Republican, I could reasonably predict what you were going to think. If you were a Democrat, I could reasonably predict what you were going to think. And it became very, very clear from the political science literature that we began to see this political sorting, which looks like polarization. I noticed shortly thereafter that this is exactly the phenomenon that we're seeing happen on college and university campuses. But that when it happens on college and university campuses, we then begin to seed future generations and what happens in the political in the political zeitgeist that from that point onward. So I kept my head down, did a lot of research very, very quietly. In 2018, I published a piece in the New York Times entitled Think Professors Are Liberal, Try School Administrators. And what I noticed was that we had a very sorted group of administrators. They were basically a homogenous, ultra-progressive group of people. And I wrote, and I quote, "We have now a fairly liberal student body being taught by a very liberal professorate and socialized, most importantly, by an incredibly liberal group of administrators." So we have administrators who are omnipresent. They serve as a thought police in many respects. They say what we can and can't say. Take a look at places like the University of North Carolina or Brandeis. They release regular guides about how to talk, what you can say, what you can't say. They run the orientations. These occur weeks before classes begin, and students are put through the ringer on numerous things they can and can't say. It gets a little dangerous. And they live in dormitories. They are all the time. They're in the dormitories. They're in student union centers now. They're everywhere. And I realized very, very quickly that this sort of dynamic is infecting what's going on with in our students. And the sorting is, again, by extension, affecting how young people see religion and community. If you're a young Jew on a college campus today, unless you're at one of the unusual religious ones or unusual conservative institutions, and there are not many, if you come in, it's very hard to be a Jew. It's very hard to be a non-liberal, ultra-progressive Jew. With the sorting, being pro-Israel is viewed as conservative. Being supportive of diversity, and more religiosity that way is viewed as more conservative. It's very, very hard to be religious and be pro-Israel and be liberal concurrently, and it's destroying our students. So what happened to our students? Well, for the most part, they either self-censored or they became ultra-progressive and have turned their back on a lot of their values. So now what we see on campus is incredible self-censorship, intimidation, and a mega decline in open inquiry. It's very, very unpleasant to be around. So let me just give you some context for all of this, and then I'll give you some new data on Jews and or Jewish students in particular, and then why I'm sort of optimistic about where we're going to go from here. So again, let me start with some of the bad news about college campuses today. So consider FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. FIRE just rebranded. It used to be the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education. FIRE has now taken on a larger project of looking at viewpoint diversity and expression, recognizing exactly what I said. The divides on campus have now percolated into quite a bit off campus. Well, 52% of liberal arts students and 53% of university students report that they silence themselves fairly regularly out of fear for social or academic consequences. That's not great. When asked, are you comfortable expressing a controversial opinion to your friends outside of class? Only 22% of college students today report that they are very comfortable doing that. How about disagreeing with a professor in a written assignment? So you have a term paper, a memo, what have you. Are you comfortable writing an opinion that disagrees with a faculty member? Only 20% of students today say that they are very comfortable. How about an in-class discussion? Today, only 16% of students report that they would be very comfortable sharing their opinions. How about posting something that's unpopular on social media? Only 13% of students today report that they are comfortable doing that. That's really problematic, and that sorting effect has basically silenced our students today. Some other just trends with that, liberal arts university colleges are far worse than universities on this. Humanities and arts disciplines are far worse than the sciences. And incidentally, religious schools, schools that are allied with, say, the church or various church denominations, are no better on this at all. So this is a little bit of a problem. So the question is, you know, why am I still somewhat optimistic on this? Over the past 3 to 4 years, we've seen a change on college campuses. This whole mess of sorting that I talked about occurred 15 to 20 years ago. This occurred after 2000. And we see this with the red states and the blue states. We see this in our political system where our parties have now just moved to the various extremes. People are confused. They're left with very bad choices. They realize that the parties give you a set of extremes and you really have to pick one or the other. It's not a pleasant world to be in. Obviously, that then affects how we think about religion and community. The reason I'm optimistic is that today, millennials are no longer on campus. We always assume young people are millennials. Millennials are have their own kids. Millennials are in their late 20s and they're in their 30s. The students on campus today are actually Gen Z, and in my view, a much more open community of students. And I've noticed this as a teacher. A number of years ago, 5, 6 years ago, you'd have a couple of angry millennial students come in. They'd be fairly aggressive. They shut down conversation and discourse and dialogue. Today, we just don't see that as often. Gen Zers, they grew up in a polarized time with a never-ending stream of digital media. I've noticed that, you know, they focus on things like the environment and gun control. They're not nearly as judgmental about faith and community. And because they have a never-ending stream of stuff off their phones like this, they tend to be more pragmatic and they tend to understand how to see various streams of evidence. So they really don't just fall into one category or another. If we look at them politically, about a third, that's it, say that they're liberal. About a quarter say that they're conservative. So neither left or right dominates here. The dominant group are people who say they're in the middle and confused. Some more stats on that I've collected over the last couple of years. In this case, more recently than that, but 47% of Gen Zers state that no party represents their views well at all. So that's, you know, that's pretty good. By comparison, just so you know, about a quarter of baby boomers say that no party represents their views particularly well at all. So Gen Z is politically homeless. Gen Zers, so the youngest group, unlike millennials, are less likely to see politics as a key part of their identity. If you look at millennials, being progressive is who they are, whereas Gen Zers far less likely to do that. By comparison, only a quarter of silent generations feel the same way, that politics is a key part of their identity. Silent generation, by the way, are folks in their late 70s and 80s. Gen Zers dislike both parties vehemently. They really, you know, about 60-65% dislike the GOP, about 50-55% dislike the Democrats. They're just disappointed. So that's something that I'm pretty optimistic about. They're not this monolithic block of progressives. A couple of other quick things that that make me fairly optimistic. If you ask students, is it a point of pride that you see the world from someone else's perspective? Almost 80% of Gen Z college students say that. That is a major strength of theirs. Similarly, 81% say they take pride in tolerating others with different beliefs. 70% say that they are open to having their views challenged. Another 70% say that they have the ability to discuss and negotiate controversial views. And almost 90% say that they are proud of their ability to work cooperatively with diverse people. So I mention this again because we have a different group of people here. And unsurprisingly, you know, if you look at college campuses today, more and more Jewish students are speaking up. And I don't think that's an accident. Yes, we've invested more money. Yes, we have more institutions doing more. But at the same time, I think students are becoming more comfortable, more open sharing who they are. Some new data that's going to be published shortly that I'm happy to share. You know, just so you know, only 12% of Americans right now believe in actually censoring books and pulling them from libraries. 80% of Americans right now believe that separating and segregating or splitting students up into racial and ethnic affinity groups is a very bad idea. Only a quarter of Americans think that changing names of buildings is a good idea. And three quarters of Americans believe that in an educational environment, you should be uncomfortable and open to having your ideas challenged, and being feeling a little weird is actually okay. So again, fairly optimistic right now that we'll be able to talk about faith and religion in a way we hadn't for a while. So, you know, this is where I think institutions matter and why I opened with a comment about the professor at UCLA. We have students who are thinking differently today. So we need institutions who can bolster and support our students on college and university campuses. There's obviously fragmentation. There are obviously problems with professors, graduate students, and administrators. But when we can, you know, support these students, things can be quite powerful and quite useful. I have some data on Jewish students, incidentally, that I thought I would share here. And that's in light of, you know, we see so much anti-Zionism, anti-Israel, anti-Semitism on campus today. Obviously, BLM is omnipresent. Flags are up all the time with that. We always talk, you know, we always hear about the terms Israeli genocide, Israeli apartheid. And this is, again, I think, fairly problematic, but again, is all part of this larger sorting dynamic, which occurred about 20 years ago, where, again, it's hard to sort of pick a selection. It's not like it's a buffet where you can choose what you'd like. Nowadays, basically, students are forced into a corner. Incidentally, I've written recently about that quite a bit, where we now see unambiguously that you know, because students have to be sorted, because they basically have two extremes to choose from, or they believe they have two extremes to choose from, you have people being swept up in one direction or the other, even when they disagree with the platforms. Eboo Patel, who is a progressive religious sort of thinker, someone I don't always agree with, has observed just recently in a Chronicle of Higher Education, he commented that there are students who say, look, I don't agree with most of these things, but this is the group I'm in. This is the group I have to be in. These are the people I work with. So I silence myself there as well. So this becomes a huge problem. Let me just throw some stats out here because I think they're good to just end here with my preliminary remarks before we talk as a group, which I'm excited about. But on the statement, is it difficult to have an open and honest conversation about Israel? Well, it turns out that 29% of college students today agree with that, but almost 70% of Jewish students agree with that. So to me, this is, again, pretty strong evidence that, you know, there's this sorting. Jews don't know what to do. Jewish students may actually want to talk about Israel differently, but they're self-censoring. And that's very, very scary. So, you know, that's an issue. They report that, you know, very clearly they're censoring. On the other hand, what's interesting is that Jews or Jewish students are leading the charge to censor others. On the question of, is it acceptable to shout down a speaker that you disagree with? About 63% of students think that that's okay. Sadly, three quarters of Jewish students feel that you can shout down a speaker. I think that's very problematic. On the question of blocking students, you know, less than half of college students believe you can block, you know, other students from entering a building to hear a speaker, but almost two thirds of Jewish students think that it's okay to block an event if you disagree with the speaker. As for violence to stop a speaker, about a quarter of students nationally feel that violence is occasionally justifiable. Jews are at the same number, so fortunately they're not higher. But again, it's a problem. So, you know, some of the data that I've been uncovering and wanted to share with you today basically shows that Jews are being silenced. And this is, again, I believe because of sorting, which is very, very scary, but they're also leading the charge to be silencers. I think it's in many cases, they don't know what to do, they're afraid. So they're now leading the charge to look even more liberal or more progressive than they probably should. Jewish students are clearly fearful. I have students in my office or on Zoom literally every week telling me how scared they are, how uncomfortable they are, and they self-silence themselves. But again, as I just showed, they're also more open to shutting down others and silencing ideas and debate. Don't know why. This could be, again, that they're trying to just fit in and you know, deal with, you know, the oppressive anti-Semitism that we're dealing with on college and university campuses today. I don't know for sure, but I guess the point I wanted to make today is that if we want to try to understand what's really going on, you know, with anti-Semitism, BDS, and the like, this is not something that should be separated, in my view, from the larger political narrative. The larger political world is now where it's not necessarily polarized, but sorted. Polarized means everyone's deeply divided. They're not. Large numbers of people are in the middle, but you do have extremes on both the left and the right. Those who are on the left and the right have really adopted a set of, you know, a set of talking points, norms, and views on one side or the other. And folks tend to now be forced into a false dichotomy, a false choice, saying you have to pick one or the other if you want to be politically engaged. Jews historically are more politically engaged. And they jump and they join one of these groups. And we have large numbers of Jewish students who obviously feel they need to be on the left, but then they join the left and they find that they're being silenced. They find that their views are not represented. They find that their ideas, preferences are being contradicted. They feel they can't talk about Israel. They feel they can't express their faith openly because, again, a progressive value is at this point is moved against faith, against family in many respects. Again, none of these are absolute statements. They should be taken with a grain of salt that there are obvious exceptions most of the time. But sadly, this sorting, in my view, has poisoned so much about what's going on our college and university campuses. And now, of course, as we see millennials becoming a significant portion of our workforce, these values have escaped the academy, have escaped the thinking of faculty members that started this in the 70s and 80s. And now it's, in my view, leading to toxic work environments, toxic community environments, you know, the obvious subsequent sense of high isolation, loneliness, and so on that we see becoming hugely problematic. Finally, you know, when we talk about isolation and sorting, certainly social media has been a huge problem here. It's only amplifying these issues. It used to be the case that, you know, you would go to a college and university, you'd have a plethora of ideas, you'd have to confront them, you couldn't avoid them, and you might grow from them. And I'm so grateful. You know, I tell folks that, you know, while I may be right of center on most things, the world was really opened up to me being a professor at Sarah Lawrence. And I'm grateful for it because I've been able to see and understand things differently. Some of it I agree with, most of it I don't, but I've been able to be more empathetic, compassionate, and understanding. And again, understand where folks are coming from. That helps us find common ground, or that helps us find policy or come up with plans that work for many people. As we become more and more likely to do things through technological intermediaries, as things like TikTok and Instagram filter and have algorithms which feed in one way or the other, this leads to increased echo chambers. It's incredibly dangerous, incredibly scary, and I think toxic to our democracy, toxic to faith, leads to radicalization, isolation, loneliness, and all these other hosts of problems that we are dealing with today. So I know we only have about 22 minutes left, so I would love to chat. So let me throw it back to Asaf. And if anyone wants to see the data, feel free to send me an email. And also almost everything I talked about has I've written out in on my website at the American Enterprise Institute. You can see it all there.
Wonderful. So
thanks for listening.
Thank you for all of that, Sam. It's very enlightening and obviously concerning, and in some ways, obviously validating to a lot of the observations that all of us who have been making all around. A lot of questions are coming in, but let me have Alex start us off, and then we'll take it from the audience.
Sure. Well, first, thanks very much for a very informative, very wide-ranging important presentation. I'll make a few very quick comments and then ask a question. My first note here is that anthropologists are the worst. That's what I wrote down. And I say that as a one-time anthropology professor. And there's a reason for that. And that's because the discipline, fundamentally, intellectually, metaphysically, you might say, gave up its emphasis on culture to talk about power. And not only the, and it became the representative of groups who it presumed were powerless. And that, I think, speaks to the aspirations of academicians in modern society. And it helped institutionalize a homogeneous group of administrators as political cadres within the institutions. But what you said about Gen Z as pragmatists, as largely apolitical, also struck a nerve, because like late baby boomers who were post-hippies like me, we were all very disillusioned with politics, and we just wanted to go about things and go through college, make some money, ruin society and our own lives in our own way. But my question is that, does this kind of pragmatism cede politics on campus and off to those who are dogmatic and those who are reactionary? And really, is the center reasserting itself on and off campus, or is it under siege? And how would a centrist reassertion work institutionally, particularly on campus? So I'll stop there.
Great questions and great comments. I agree completely with your read on anthropology. I also say that as someone who adores reading anthropology and collects it as much as I can, I don't know if it's PC to say, I like Ted Bester's work at this point. I know he's under investigation, but I've loved his work on Japan and I very, very, very much. One thing about anthropology that I also like to mention is take a look at department websites and various anthropological professional organizations, and you're absolutely right. The mission statements have changed so drastically over the past decade to capture exactly what you're saying, and I find that frustrating. As for the center reasserting itself, phenomenal question. I don't know yet. The most recent election in 2020 is when we saw Gen Z develop a political voice for the first time. They certainly organized. They certainly were anti-Trump. They were not particularly pro-Biden either. That keeps showing up in the data. The support for the current Biden administration is waning considerably. So for me, the question in 2022 and then 2024 is, will some centrist pragmatic group emerge? Right now, it does not appear as if there is much formal organization or leadership for this group at all. Social media may be contributing to that by fracturing it so much that it's hard to say who is speaking for this group. Off year or off presidential cycle elections are a little bit of a challenge to get a sense of what that means for Gen Z. But I think the question, and I think it's the great question that we need to answer, and we're going to know hopefully in November, is, are these folks being overwhelmed and are they going to stay home, or will they be able to be re-engaged or engage and assert themselves? From what I can tell, spending enough time on college campuses now, again, it's been a little unusual with COVID in the last couple of months, but it appears as if this group is ready to really assert itself, from what I can tell, because they really are fed up and they don't want to be marginalized. But I don't know yet. Fairly large numbers are saying they want to vote. Fairly large numbers are saying they intend on looking for candidates that they support. The question, I think, is, will there be enough candidates for these folks to support and that can take a centrist enough set of positions? I don't know. But I think basically what you've asked is one of the most important questions that political science and the media are going to have to try to really bear down on hard. Yeah, after 2022, to see what happens to this generation. What we do know is that, at least from a socialization standpoint, what happens now will set the tone for the generation for decades to come, at least if you look at past generational moments of coming of age. So it's really going to matter. My fear is that if you have a Trump-Biden rematch, we may deflate this generation for decades to come, and the center may not reassert itself, and we may end up in a far worse spot than we should. But I don't know, and I'm sorry for being pessimistic on that.
It's all good. Thank you. Alex, you're good. We're going to go to the audience.
Let's move on. Thank you.
Great. All right. So our friend Tom Levy out in San Diego is asking a question about, stating, of course, that, you know, many universities today, of course, have now chief administrators promoting DEI, and they're the ones in power and running the universities, as you know so well. Isn't it really impossible to go back to the liberal open dialogue on our campuses? And, you know, do you have any thoughts on how to, if it's, is there a path or is not a path? Is it, you know, a path, you know, that, you know, it should be given up on or not? But what do you think about that?
So it's not just DEI. The latest term is JEDI. I'm surprised Lucasfilm is okay with this. JEDI is justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion. Just to add that new term to the mix, feel free to use it as much as you like. Students are fed up with this. This is now something that the general population knows about. This is not something that was well understood even a decade ago, even though the seeds have been germinating now for many, many decades. You know, change occurs slowly, sadly. You know, the JEDI movement did not come overnight, although it certainly appeared as if it did. You know, this stuff was being laid out in the 70s and 80s and even mid to mid 90s. It really bloomed under the Obama administration through the Ed Department's guidance and the Dear John letters. I think that stuff can be rolled back. Schools, you know, we're going to be facing an enrollment cliff in a few years, just demographically. Schools are not going to be able to afford the massive infrastructures that they currently have. They're going to have to rethink what they're doing considerably. This is where administrators can be cut. We don't need many of them. This is not to say that they're all horrible. They're not. And many administrators do provide great services, but we need to trim the fat, if you will, very, very, very much. The other thing to note is that there are many, many groups like FIRE and ACTA, and I'm honored to be able to say I work with both of them to try to raise the awareness of this. So various constituencies, whether they're state governments who fund public institutions, whether they're parents and prospective students, push back and say, we don't need this. Tuition is too high. We don't need this sort of toxic environment. Maybe enrollment will change as a result of it. Maybe not. I'm optimistic that it will. It's also the case that you know, various branches of the government, there are now members of Congress who are looking into this saying, what do we do about this? The consequences of DEI or JEDI are severe. You know, we don't like the silencing of students. We don't like the minimization of viewpoint diversity. And the result of this is that Congress may enact legislation to create a viewpoint diversity office at some point in the Ed Department. And it could work very similarly to the Title IX offices and tie federal funding, you know, to it. So, you know, that happens. You're going to see universities pause in their tracks and reevaluate this because, you know, no university wants to lose its federal funding right now. So I think we are now really in the midst of chaos. You know, you see these JEDI offices expanding, but at the same time, students are going, wait, what are we doing here? Students don't want to take out loans to pay for these salaries. And more importantly, they don't want to be told what to say, what they can ask and what they can't ask. They don't like it. So I think we're going to see the pendulum begin to swing in the other direction. And again, thanks to groups like FIRE, the Heterodox Academy, ACTA, which is the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, and then quite frankly, considerable interest in the public sphere. We see this happening in Virginia. We see this happening in Florida. Now, again, some of that stuff may be too extreme. And in many cases, I think it is too extreme. But there is pushback. And it's going to be a little bumpy for a while. But I do think that you know, some sanity will reemerge. That's why I still stay in higher ed. That's why I have not quit. I think the consequences are too severe and our future as a nation is too important if we don't, you know, really live up to our dream of open discourse, debate, and actually freedom of thought. As a Jewish guy, you know, I was either going to be a rabbi or a professor. I went the professor route. I used to love it. I still love being a teacher. And want to make sure that younger students, younger generations understand the joy of having their minds blown when you hear something you didn't know and having your ideas challenged and your views changed.
Great, thank you. Yeah, discourse and idea and inquisitive research, there's a novelty given the echo chamber. But putting that aside and seriously, a segue to your point about, you know, the funding when it comes to universities. part of the, a thought that comes to mind now is, of course, that part of the portfolio of anti-Semitism falls within these Jedi DEI officers. You know, we're now seeing a lot of court cases regarding the IRA definition in campuses. Are you seeing, you know, also with the data that you've looked at, some kind of correlation as far as the money, whether or not they're, as far as discriminatory actions regarding the anti-Semitism? Because what we've also observed is that some of these officers, when the problem falls on their desk, can't identify anti-Semitism and discrimination, and, you know, therein lies the problem. Are you seeing some movement there, or is that still, you know, an area of obviously a great deal of work that needs to happen as far as educating these officers as to what the problem is, and to come up with actual solutions rather than, making the problem grow?
So two comments. Number one, a lot of this is hidden and black boxed, so I can't see it, especially at private universities and colleges. We will be able to see it at public institutions. So that's a good start. We'll eventually see all of it at public institutions. It will obviously have to be redacted, and we'll get to see a lot more of it. On the education and training issue, yeah, I think the problem is that we now have too many of these diversity officers who themselves, in my view, are often anti-Semitic, who genuinely believe that this stuff is not problematic. One thing I should point out is that I'm going to have some data and research coming out that if you look at some of these DEI individuals, they actually see themselves as activists. If you ask what they do on a daily basis, they actually will tell you that they see themselves as there to push a social agenda. So they are overtly political. That scares the you-know-what out of me. That's not what they're there to do. So we need to be very, very careful, especially as this stuff falls in DEI offices, that, you know, it doesn't matter what their personal views are. They're welcome to hold any view they want. And that's one of the first things, incidentally, I teach my students. I will never malign your personal views, but you better, be able to tell me where they come from. Hopefully they'll be reasonable in terms of, you know, using logic, reason, data, and evidence. And we need to figure out, how you can defend them or not. But, you know, the concern is that I don't care what someone's views are, but you need to make a good argument. You need to be able to justify it in a paper with logic, again, evidence, and go back and forth. I'll never ding you if I disagree with you. I want to disagree with you. I love that. So the issue here is the same thing. The DEI officers can hold whatever views they need to personally want to hold, but they still need to be able to maintain viewpoint diversity, understand what real anti-Semitism is, and act on it regardless of their own personal views. So that's something we need to work on very heavily. And I don't think we've done an adequate job to date whatsoever, actually.
Great. Thank you. Let me unmute our friend Ernie Sternberg and see if... and let's see if we can connect them. Ernie, can you hear us?
Can you hear me? Yes,
yes, we can. Go ahead.
Hi, everyone. I suppose you can't see me, though, correct?
No, we can hear you. Go ahead.
You can hear me. Okay, that's fine. So there is the Heterodox Academy, which I'm a part of, as I see you are. But their subject matter is pretty much the whole problem you're talking about, rather than the substantive subjects that academics work on. I'm at SUNY at Buffalo, by the way. Then we have a great organization, ASMEA, but that one is small, has a great group of people, but focuses only on Middle East studies. And the problem for people who have the same concern that you do is that there's no place, for example, I teach urban planning. There's no place to meet people with similar substantive interests to discuss these difficulties? Or do you know of a place? Or is there an emergency organization or academic journal or anything like that where one can have these discussions, to your knowledge?
So Heterodox does have, so I'm not as active in Heterodox as I used to be. I think Heterodox has been very, very useful in providing various forums or fora for this. There are local chapters now of this. And there are a number here in the New York City region. I know that may be a little too far, but I can certainly put you in touch with the Heterodox people to see if there's enough of a critical mass to put together some meetups in, near you, if possible. I can't obviously expect you to drive all the way down to Manhattan or anything like that. But no, there aren't enough. And that's, again, why I opened my comments with my concern about the UCLA professor. You know, doing this alone can be very scary. Obviously, being, you know, you can feel very isolated. Having a community behind you can be incredibly powerful and useful, both intellectually and just emotionally. So no, I don't. You know, obviously we have FAIR, we have ACTA, FIRE, and so on. But you know, I can reach out to Heterodox a little bit more and see if there are groups. I guess what do we call that? The Empire region. To see if there's enough of a critical mass up there that you could meet with some other folks. I think that would be certainly a good thing to try. But no, I don't think there are more groups than that. There are basically five or six. And, you know, you have the Academic Freedom Alliance and so on, but these are just political groups, and not to diminish AFA at all, it's a wonderful group, but that's much more of a political action group right now, but it doesn't necessarily have meetups yet or anything like that.
Right. And by the way, you know, as Ernie knows, and as you know, Sam, as well, I mean, part of what we've been seeing all around, one of the main primary reasons that SPME was created is because of a lack of community and people feeling isolated and lonely, you know, and these part of these conversations that are happening are not happening, which is part of, you know, the reason to really create as many forms as possible. Let me move on to our friend Bud Gertesman, who's asking a question. He's asking a question about, do you agree that Jewish students are more likely to be more woke than non-Jewish students? And I guess ties into some of the work that you just wrote recently about with Jack Wertheimer. Are you finding that, you know, and I'll just add, you know, you're seeing the replacement theology as it relates to Judaism as liberalism, as social justice. Is that more of a growing phenomenon as the Jewish wokeness in that correlation?
Yeah, so I just wrote a piece with Jack Wertheimer from JTS. It's in Tablet. Highly recommend taking a look, please. It's still free and open source. Wrote a piece before that called Woke, which leads up into the Tablet piece for commentary a number of months earlier. And in both pieces, we do make the argument that in the absence of various institutions, people are still craving connections. And one of the ways they do that is what just Asaf described. They take on the mantle of these, in my view, very poorly conceptualized ideologies and belief systems because they don't have the same communal organizations. They no longer have the same religious organizations that provide sort of that structure and that meaning and that connection. In terms of the question of what do Jews and Jewish campus students look like, what I would say is I don't think that that we actually see more wokeness and abandonment of these ideas. I see a lot of self-censorship over and over and over again. I see a lot of students signing up for things so they don't get mobbed. But once you talk to students, and you know, again, pre-COVID and even in the midst of the getting out of this mess, whenever I speak, you know, I will get hundreds of emails in some cases from students saying they were afraid to talk, but they want to talk this out now, or people will line up and try to talk to me after these events. We don't have great survey data on this. It's very hard and expensive to survey Jewish students. It's just a very small number of people relatively, and to reach them, it's fairly costly, so we don't do enough of this. But I think this is what we call tyranny of the minority, which is what we see a lot in political science, which is certain groups are more active, more coordinated. It tends to be folks on the left. They make a lot of noise. They get a lot of attention. They set an agenda, whether or not it's real. What I have to tell my students over and over again is, for instance, Twitter is not real. Only a very small subset of Americans are on Twitter. It tends to be people who are on the left and very, very loud and very, very reactionary. I think we see a very vocal reactionary set of Jewish students, often led by a reactionary set of Jewish leaders and organizations outside the academy that they may be part of. And I think that creates a very, very real perception that the Jewish students have gone this way. You know, I want to be clear that while I don't agree with all the research on things like birthright, there are still significant numbers of students on college campuses that believe in Israel, that believe in the importance of faith, family, religious tradition. They're just afraid to speak up. I think about when I was at Stanford, for instance, Hillel was basically non-existent. There were very few faculty members who took any interest in talking about Jewish life and Jewish community. I felt very isolated, very alone. It was a very big problem. Had I been at a place like University of Pennsylvania, I would have had a totally different experience. And I may have become much more political and much more conservative overtly outright much earlier in my life. The point is to say that, you know, I think that if the conditions are right, it takes Sarah Lawrence because of who I am. There are dozens and dozens of students, and dozens matter to a school of only 1,100. So let me say scores of students who are much more conservative, much more pro-Israel, much more pro-faith than you might think. They just needed someone to help support them. So no, I think this is, again, a tyranny of the minority issue where we see this emerge as a result of a loud, coordinated group. But my sense is it's not as extreme or bad as it could be.
Great. Sam, you know, this has been great. Unfortunately, you know, our time has come to an end, and in short wise, but obviously, you know, you've given us a lot to think about, and there's, you know, obviously a full swatch of covering, you know, the space as we see it. Hopefully you can come back, you know, when you have more studies to share with us, and we'd love to have you back in person and obviously online. As always, I want to thank everybody for joining us this afternoon. I apologize for not getting to everybody's questions. As I mentioned before, we tried to cover a lot in a short amount of time. Please feel free to email us at bdsmonitor@spme.org, bdsmonitor@spme.org. Look out for future webinar sessions. I hope everybody is obviously staying safe and well. And wherever you're located on the East Coast or the West Coast, good morning and good afternoon. As always, I want to thank my friend and colleague Alex Jaffe for joining me, and really, Sam, thank you for taking the time.
Sure. If anyone's in New York, send me a note. I would love to meet up for a beverage anytime. I'm here and happy to do it.
We'll have to make that happen. So I wish everybody a good day. Sam, I'm glad that you're, you know, slowly getting into your move, and thank you for taking the time in the move. Sure. To talk to us. And we will talk soon. So everybody have a good day, and look out for future notices. Thank you very much.
Thank you.